Hi everyone. Thank you for attending. So today I want to talk to you about this work, which was recently presented at QIP, it's joint work with Oliver Reed and Smith and Camille Kojakwa from Krakow and Stephen Bartlett from the University of Sydney. So the main task I want to focus on today is Bournemouth probability estimation. And it's useful to have this circuit in mind. This should be read from right to left. We start off with an n-qubit system in the all zero state. And then we're going to apply a sequence of gates. And the set of gates we're allowed to use are Clifford gates or these T-phi gates, which are arbitrary angle Z rotations, where we allow angles in this interval. So I should say that this gate set is universal. And so after applying a sequence of these T non-Clifford gates and Cliffords, we end up here. And in order to specify a Bournemouth rule probability, we need to specify a measurement and an outcome of interest. So we look at measuring the first W qubits where W is a variable, and we specify a bit string X that determines the outcome of interest. So given this computational basis measurement, one can project this quantum state onto the outcome X and discard this measurement register. And what we're left with is this unnormalized quantum state here. And the Bournemouth probability can be written as the squared two norm of this unnormalized quantum state. So the main task we want to focus on is to classically estimate this quantity, this Bournemouth probability. So I want to say that this is a kind of a fundamental task that's from which you can do things like estimate the expectation values of Pauli's. And is in general hard to classically do. So like it contains BQP, if you could estimate this to additive error. This has a number of practical applications, which I won't go into in detail, but I should say that if you work or think about verification of near-term quantum devices and have an opinion about the application of this in that field, I'd be very interested in talking to you. So before I move on, is there any questions about the setup? Okay. Today I'll present a kind of suite of algorithms that address this task. And this is, to our knowledge, the new state of the art for solving this problem. So we start off with some elementary description of the Bournemouth probability, which is in terms of this quantum circuit and measurement. And given this description, we feed this into our first algorithm, which we call Compress. And Compress will output a bunch of circuit-specific data that is going to be useful for quickly estimating the Bournemouth probability. So the first thing Compress might do is actually tell you that the Bournemouth probability is exactly zero. And if this is the case, then the problem is solved. However, if this does not happen, then it'll output an integer r. And if r is large, we should use our computer algorithm to proceed. And our computer algorithm will compute the Bournemouth probability to machine precision. So it's like a exact computation of the Bournemouth probability. If, however, we're in the harder case and r is small, then we should use our feature algorithm, which we call estimate, which will output an additive precision estimate of the Bournemouth probability. This estimate algorithm will use a key sub procedure, which we call raw estim, to do this. So all of the algorithms I discussed today are available at this link here, courtesy of Oliver Reed and Smith, who has done all the coding and all the work on this. We hope that this will soon be on Qiskit as well, but don't really have an idea of time frame for that. And so the main focus of this talk is really going to be introducing these algorithms and how they work, and maybe that's some of the key ideas behind them. Okay, is there any questions on this? Great. Okay, so I want to start off with the compress algorithm. So this has really three key steps. The first of this is well-known tool called gadgetization. So we start, we're given this kind of description of the Bournemouth probability in the form of this circuit. And the first thing we do using compress is convert this this unitary component that's non-Clifford into a Clifford. And that's done by adding an additional register of T qubits, one for each of these non-Clifford gates. And then replacing these with this C nod as per this picture. So this register is initialized in the zero state, but after applying the C nods, we post-select on some magic state. This magic state is a product of single qubit magic states, where each of the single qubit magic states is an equatorial state of this form that depends on an angle. Which comes from this gate angle here. So having gone through this procedure, what we've done is we've removed all of the non-Cliffords at the cost of having to add an additional register and post-select on a non-stabilizer state. But what we are guaranteed if we do this procedure is that this output state here is proportional to the state that's output at the end of this process. So in particular, I recall that the Bournemouth probability could be written as the square two norm of this output state. And so now we could, up to a factor, write the Bournemouth probability as the square two norm of this state. And so the Bournemouth probability can be written in this form, where this pi g double dash is a projector constructed from this component of the circuit. So it's the outer product of this stabilizer state. Okay, so that's kind of the first step in the compress algorithm. And then the main kind of workhorse of this algorithm is this constraint step, which I'm not going to go into in any level of detail. But constraint basically manipulates this projector to a smaller projector such that this equation holds. So this projector up here was a n plus t qubit stabilizer projector. And this here is a t qubit stabilizer projector, which can be computed and defined in terms of the generators corresponding to this projector. And it's kind of defined and identified by applying a series of constraints on the generators that define this projector. Okay, that's all I'll say about this, unless people have questions. And so the final step of this algorithm is a process we call construct, where this Clifford is constructed from this projector such that this equation holds. So now we could write the Bournemouth probability as a magic state that's acted on by a sequence of elementary Clifford gates with some post-selection on a stabilizer state. Okay, so that's the compressed algorithm in a nutshell. So let me just summarize that. So what this does is, given this elementary description of the Bournemouth probability, this algorithm efficiently outputs the location of each of some deterministic outcome qubits and specifies the outcome. So for example, it might say for this particular circuit you've given me, qubits 1 and 3 will always produce a deterministic outcome. Qubit 1 must always produce a 0 outcome. Qubit 3 must always produce a 1 outcome, for example. So in addition to that, it'll output a stabilizer generating set G, which is a T qubit, which has length T palis, And there's T minus R of them in total. And this generating set will satisfy this equation. So if we define the projector based on this generating set, then the Bournonian probability can be written in this form. And this this number R, which is also output, and this number R is kind of key to runtimes, is a key determinant of runtimes of various algorithms. And this number R is kind of defined from here, and can it also be thought of as the log of the rank of this projector here. And finally, this algorithm outputs elementary description of this Clifford circuit W, such that this form of the Bournonian probability holds. And so I should say that this form of the Bournonian probability is going to be useful for our compute algorithm, while this form is going to be useful for our estimate algorithm. Okay. So I'm done with talking about compress, and I'm going to move on to talking about compute. But are there any questions for the time being?
Sorry, I think I missed something. What are V and W and the exponent again?
Oh, right. I didn't kind of really talk about these. So V is going to be the number of qubits that this algorithm specifies or identifies as deterministic outcome qubits. So when you run this compress algorithm, it might tell you that a certain subset of the measured qubits are deterministic in their outcome, which means every time you run the circuit and make that measurement, you're always going to see the same outcome for these qubits that have like 100% probability of either being 0 or 1. So V is the number of these qubits. And W is the number of measured qubits.
Cool, thank you.
Hakop, what is a script G again?
This guy here?
Yeah.
I just kind of implicitly discuss what that was without really actually saying it. But I kind of use this as the set of generators, like stabilizer generators, which contain T qubit, like the T qubit generators, and there's T minus R of them. So it's kind of like the set of all of these. So the fact that G is in this just basically says that G is a T qubit generator with T minus R elements.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so I want to now talk about compute. So this algorithm exactly computes the Bournonian probability in this runtime, and one should note that there's exponential dependence on this quantity T minus R. And I should say exactly computes. I'm going to use this as a shorthand for computes to machine precision, which is close to exact. This algorithm will use this string of stabilizer generators that's output by compress in order to do its thing. And it'll use this form of the Bournonian probability that we saw earlier. And this can easily be massaged into this form here. And so if we just kind of expand this product here, which is I plus GI, these are the generators. Once you expand out this product, you're going to get 2 to the T minus R terms. Each term is going to be a Pauli string of length T. And so if you look at each term, it's going to be expectation value of a Pauli string with respect to a magic state. And the magic state's a product state, so it's easy to compute this expectation value. And there's 2 to the T minus R terms in total. And so this is exactly where the runtime comes from. You have 2 to the T minus R terms. Each of them takes this long to compute. And so this algorithm is really a very kind of straightforward brute force algorithm once given the inputs and the structure. But despite the seeming simplicity of this algorithm, it can be surprisingly effective for large circuits. So as an example, we can kind of generate 55 qubit circuits where we measure 5 of the qubits, and there's 80 T gates and 100,000 Cliffords. And a circuit of this size, you can produce exact Bournonian probabilities in less than 2 hours. which to us was very surprising. If you want to kind of understand, you know, how could this be? It's really because of the behavior of this quantity R. So R has to be in this range where the maximum value it can take is the minimum of T, which is the number of non-Clifford elements, and N minus W, which is the number of not measured qubits. When we look at the behavior of R, we see that R actually concentrates near its maximum for high Clifford count random circuits. And and so in this example here, N minus W is 50, which is less than 80. So R max is 50. And so if R actually tends to be near R max 50, then this exponent here is 2 to the 30, which is manageable. And it gives pretty fast things. And so if you get, an exponent that's well less than 30, you're gonna deal with this quite well using this algorithm. When exponents get to 40, it becomes really unmanageable. Okay, so just to kind of look a little bit more at the concentration, we did some simulations where we generated 1,000 random circuits, each of which was had 100 qubits. 20 of these were measured, and there were 80 T gates. So this corresponds to a R max of 80. And there were 100,000 Cliffords applied, which we kind of chose randomly in each for each circuit. And then we plotted a histogram of T minus R, and you find that they're all less than 5. And so running these would be super fast, which is nice. But I should kind of point out something. I should take this result with a grain of salt, which is that this result says that typically R is near R max. But also you would expect that typically for these kinds of circuits, the Bonneville probability is consistent with uniform distribution. You measure W qubits, you expect to find the probability is 1/2 W. And so, it's kind of fair to ask the question, is this algorithm just working for all of these trivial cases where the probability is essentially uniform? You can certainly pick out examples where the probability isn't uniform and still the algorithm works well, but obviously they're rare amongst the frequent cases of uniform. So I guess there's this kind of question of when do we get practical simulations using this algorithm while P is still non-uniform? So understanding what these circuits are is interesting. And a closely related kind of open question is, are there any interesting applications for this compute algorithm where there's actually a practical problem to be solved and this algorithm addresses it in a practical way? Despite this kind of unanswered question, for our purposes, this compute algorithm really is important because it works with our estimate algorithm in the sense that we get this kind of two scenarios where R is large and where R is small. And despite the fact that R is large is this kind of common situation, and in this case, the compute algorithm works well. So that leaves the R is small case to be addressed. And that case is kind of perhaps the less frequent but richer setting, which is entirely addressed by our estimate algorithm. So these, by having both of these algorithms, they work together to kind of solve the problem entirely. Okay, so are there any more questions before I move on to discussing the estimate algorithm? Okay, so that's the compute algorithm. So now I want to kind of focus on this block here. And in particular, I want to first start off by talking about the raw estim sub-procedure that's used in our estimate algorithm. Okay, So this sub-procedure is going to use this form of vulnerable probability. And so I just want to stare at this for a second. So we note that we have this T qubit product state, and we're going to evolve it under some Clifford. But then we're going to project and discard the first T minus R qubits. And so what we're going to be left with is a unnormalized R qubit quantum state. And so this mu is going to be this unnormalized R qubit quantum state. And the vulnerable probability is the squared 2 norm of mu. Okay, so the way we're going to solve this is we're going to first, well, we first define for every bit string of length T, we define an unnormalized stabilizer state psi y and a product distribution qy, such that the expectation value of psi y with respect to this probability distribution is mu. So what that means is, you know, if you with this probability distribution sample at y, then output this state, the expectation value of that output is going to be mu. Okay, so you know, armed with this kind of setup, we can apply this concentration inequality, which we show in our paper, and hope that it finds application outside of classical simulation of quantum systems. This concentration inequality was based on a result by Hayes, and kind of tells us maybe one could think of this as a vector version of the Hofding inequality. So essentially, what it says is, if you randomly sampled a bunch of these y's based on this distribution, and then constructed these psi y's, let's call them psi 1 to psi s, you construct s of them, sample s of them. So you construct this empirical average of these vectors, which we call psi y, then this concentration inequality tells you how quickly psi y converges to mu. So in particular, it tells you that the outer product is close to this projector here in trace norm. So the probability that it's more than epsilon away is suppressed. It's exponentially decays in S. So this is some positive component. So it's exponentially decaying in S. And obviously the size of this is important. The bigger it is, the smaller S has to be to ensure a certain failure probability. And so I should remind you that P here is the squared 2 norm of mu. And so the smaller p is, the larger this becomes, and the smaller s we need in order to ensure a certain failure probability. So smaller p is good, and m is an upper bound on the length of all of the psi y's, and m appears in the denominator here. So large m is bad, small m is good. And we're able to show that a quantity known as the stabilizer extent is an upper bound on all the square two norms of these psi y's, which means we could replace m by the stabilizer extent in this equation here. Okay, so now, you know, given this kind of the setup of these psi y's and this concentration inequality, the task of vulnerable probability estimation kind of becomes a lot simpler. So now, you know, the goal is the following. We want to estimate the trace of this quantity here, which is the squared two norm of mu, which is the Born probability. And what we're going to do is estimate the trace of this quantity. So that's the squared two norm of a linear combination of stabilizer states. And given this inequality, we can guarantee that the trace of this is close to the trace of this. Okay, so now the task simply reduces to estimating the square two norm of a linear combination of stabilizer states. For that, there's already a really nice algorithm. So our final output of our estimate, of our vulnerable probability estimate, is simply the estimate of the square two norm. which uses L iterations of this Bravi-Gossett fast norm estimation algorithm from this paper in order to kind of produce the bottom probability estimate. So I should mention that we use something called the CH form, which was introduced in this Bravi et al. Result in order to keep track of our stabilizers to construct these psi-y's or to compute these psi-y's quickly. So the CH form is a phase-sensitive method for manipulating stabilizer states. So we know and are familiar with the Gottesman-Neel theorem and the kind of standard methods for manipulating stabilizer states and simulating them. But these don't keep track of global phase. And because we're dealing with linear combinations of stabilizer states, if we simulate each individual stabilizer state, we need to keep track of its phase, because when we put it into the linear combination, those global phases are going to now become relative phases. And so the CH form gives us the ability to keep track of these global phases so that when we put all the results together in here, we don't lose track of relative phases. So this formalism was introduced in this paper, but in our paper, we kind of contributed a little to this by showing how the CH form can be factorized. So for example, given a product state like this, given the CH form of a product state like this, you might want to pull out the CH form of one of the factors. And this is surprisingly non-trivial because of the high level of redundancy in the representation of the CH form. If you use this, it might be useful to you. So there's another there's other tricks we use to kind of speed up our algorithm, but I won't really go into any detail. But I should maybe say a word about the stabilizer extent. I can't really, I don't really have time to define or discuss the stabilizer extent in detail, but the runtime of this algorithm depends linearly on the behavior of the stabilizer extent and is the only source of inefficiency in the algorithm. So I should at least kind of talk about how that scales. So the stabilizer extent is a product of the stabilizer extent of the single qubit magic states. And these are given by this function here. That's a function of the angle. And so we see here that at pi on 4, which corresponds to the T gate, the stabilizer extent is a maximum and it takes a value of around 1.17. So we expect the stabilizer extent to be a kind of mildly scaling exponential. I think I can now summarize the raw SDM algorithm. So given an S and L, which is kind of, recall that S is the number of samples we're going to take of these stabilizer states and before we form like this linear or average. And L was the number of iterations we were going to use of the fast norm estimation algorithm to estimate the length of this average vector. So we're free to choose S and L, but given an S and L, this sub-procedure will compute an estimate in this runtime, which is linear in S and L, and all other factors are kind of manageable because R is smaller than T, and T is nothing is exponential there except possibly S and L. This is the runtime, and what does it produce? Well, it produces a Bornwood probability that's within this additive error with high probability or with a failure probability given by this equation here. This looks like a big equation, but we can break it up into two bits. So it's really the sum of two decaying exponentials. The first decays in S, and the second decays in L. And so we can kind of bundle this all up into this one function that's like the failure probability of this equation. So we somehow not done yet, and the reason we're not finished is because this failure probability depends on the unknown Bornwood probability P. And so this algorithm doesn't really give us a guarantee on the performance on its performance, because you know, knowing its performance requires us to know what the unknown Bournonal probability is. However, you know, one can easily remedy this situation by simply setting p equals one in here, and that's because this thing is a monotone increasing function in p, and so setting p equals one upper bounds this failure probability. So one could just use that and be done, but this is conservative, and in principle we could get away with better runtimes if we did something a little less naive, and that's really the focus of and the main goal of the estimate algorithm, to improve on runtime by not using this shortcut p equals one. Okay, so are there any questions about this sub-procedure before I move on? Okay. So I've talked about the sub-procedure, and now I'm gonna talk about the final kind of key algorithm, the estimate algorithm. Okay, so the purpose of estimate is for a given additive error and failure probability, it produces a estimate that satisfies this equation. And the way estimate will work is by using this raw estim sub-procedure on repeated rounds. So estimate will feed a choice of S and L to the sub-procedure and receive an estimate, and it'll kind of iterate until it gets to a point where it knows that this equation is satisfied, and so it'll output an estimate at that point and this loop. Okay, so recall that the raw estim algorithm kind of satisfied an equation that almost looks like this, except this failure probability depends on p. And so to kind of give you a high level sketch of how this algorithm works, it's useful to define this function epsilon star. So let me just talk a little about, first maybe talk about what its inputs are. So this this t, we should think of this as a total runtime budget, or a runtime budget for each round that this sub-procedure is allowed to use. So it cannot use, it's kind of an upper bound on the amount of runtime it's allowed to use on a particular call. This is the failure probability that, the maximum failure probability that it can have, and this is the Bournonal probability. And so we define this epsilon star function as the minimal achievable additive error such that this sub-procedure, or subject to this sub-procedure having a runtime less than the budget and the failure probability less than the delta total, the given failure probability. And so, you know, with this kind of definition in hand, it's easy to show that this equation holds. So this says that an estimate produced by raw estim can have an additive error as small as this, with a failure probability as small as this. So this is something that's achievable. In addition, so we're able to show that this function is monotone increasing in p, which is going to be critical to our argument. So with this, let me just kind of, what I'm going to do is kind of sketch out a basic idea that's kind of on the right track, but doesn't quite work, and then improve that to the kind of idea that does work. So the first idea is we're going to have a bunch of rounds. In each round, we're going to make a call to this sub-procedure, and the rounds are going to be indexed by 1, 2, 3, and so on. And so in each round, what we're going to do is evaluate this this function. But in each round, we're going to give our sub-procedure some budgeted runtime. So initially the budgeted runtime is going to be very small. So small that it couldn't possibly produce an estimate with the required accuracy. But in each round, we're going to double the budgeted runtime. So the total budgeted runtime is going to grow exponentially in the round number. And very quickly, we're going to have enough budgeted runtime for the sub-procedure to produce accurate estimates. And so what we, all we need to do is kind of evaluate this function at each round. And at the first point that this function becomes less than the additive error, you know, we know that we've kind of achieved the accuracy we need, and we output the central estimate in that round. But of course, there's a problem with this, because we can't actually compute this function because it still depends on this unknown Bournonal probability P. And so what we do is, by noting that this is a monotone increasing function in P, we could use any upper bound on P to upper bound the additive error. And so that's what we're going to do. What we do is we start off with the initial upper bound for the Bournonal probability, which is 1. And then in each subsequent round, we can produce a new upper bound based on the last central estimate of the Bournonal probability, but we add to it the maximum additive error, or an upper bound on the additive error we could have in that round. And so this produces a probabilistic upper bound on the Bournonal probability, a running probabilistic upper bound, which then feeds into the next estimate. So you know, after a number of rounds, we're going to get to something that's smaller than epsilon total, and at that point we call it n to the procedure. But I mean, there's one more thing, which is that each call to the sub procedure needs to have a failure probability that depends on the round number. And we're going to choose this failure dependence on the round number in this way, such that even if we had an infinite number of rounds, the sum of these failure probabilities will be less than the desired total failure probability. So by the union bound, we guarantee that we'll also not fail with probability higher than the desired failure probability. And so this is what it looks like when we run this algorithm on an actual circuit. So here, these blue dots represent the probability upper bounds on each subsequent call of each round. So you see here that we start with a upper bound of 1, and very quickly, this upper bound decays to something close to the true Bournonal probability. These red dots here represent the central estimates produced in each round. And on the right here, we're plotting the additive error upper bounds in each round. And we see that it decays, and at some point it becomes less than the desired total additive error. And at the first point that it becomes less than that, we can call an end to the procedure and output the central estimate at that round as our total estimate for the Bournonal probability. So this data was produced based on a 50 qubit circuit where 8 qubits were measured. This had 16 non-Clifford gates, but in its stabilizer rank, it was equivalent to 52 T gates. Okay. Are there any questions about this? Okay, so the estimate algorithm for a desired additive error and a failure probability, it satisfies this equation. But note that now we've pushed this kind of the sub procedure had a dependence on P here, but we've now pushed this dependence on P into the runtime. So now the runtime is going to depend on P and is also probabilistic. But we also present this algorithm called runtime, which gives a probabilistic upper bound on the runtime of estimate for any choice of P. So any possible P, you get this. So in this figure here, we have P on the x-axis here. And as a function of P, this stepped red curve is showing the output at runtime. So it's showing you how the upper bound on the runtime scales in P for a particular circuit. This scale here is in terms of the number of elementary operations as opposed to actual runtime. But just to kind of give you an idea of scale, This data point here corresponds to roughly 8 minutes. Okay, so this, as I said, this is the upper bound for the runtime, but these black dots here are the actual runtimes produced from running a number of circuits with different vulnerable probabilities. So these are the circuit parameters, and we've chosen these circuits such that all parameters that drive runtime stay the same, and the only thing that changes is the vulnerable probability. And each of these data points is actually a cluster of 2 to 3 data points, but they're so close to each other that you can't really resolve them. And this blue line here is kind of it's the optimal runtime one could achieve using the sub procedure. If one could tune all the parameters precisely or optimally, knowing exactly what P was. So it's not really a achievable runtime because you'll never know what P is if you're trying to estimate it. However, you know, it kind of shows you how, you know, in the ideal circumstance, how fast this procedure could be. So that's what this blue line is. Okay. So let me just compare this to kind of the previous state of the art, which for this choice of circuit parameters sits up here. So there's actually two algorithms, but they both coincide in their runtime that sit up here. Note that these are both going to be, their runtime is independent of the vulnerable probability itself, unlike our results. So what am I comparing to? I'm comparing these two these two results here. So the first here, this Brabi and Gossett paper. In this paper, they presented an algorithm for sampling from the output distribution of Clifford plus T circuits. And that sampling algorithm contains a key subprocedure, which can be used to estimate vulnerable probabilities. And I'm comparing to the runtime of this key subprocedure. And in addition, in this Brabi et al. Paper, they present a sampling algorithm that they call the sum over Clifford's algorithm. And again, this sampling algorithm uses a key subprocedure that can be used to estimate vulnerable probabilities, and I'm comparing to that runtime. So to kind of break down this performance comparison, it's useful to kind of break it down into these two components. This component here of the runtime improvement is a factor of roughly 100. And this component arises from the use of this kind of learning algorithm, this estimate algorithm that learns the vulnerable probability. So this component is the improvement that's P dependent, and it's the improvement you get from using this kind of learning algorithm as opposed to just setting P equals one and using the more naive approach. Just using the sub procedure with P set to one. Okay. And this component of the algorithm, this component of the improvement, which is again a factor of roughly 100, comes from the fact that the runtime of these algorithms scale like in this case n cubed and in this case t cubed, whereas this line here scales like r cubed. And so in this case, we're looking at N and T, which are both 40. So we're looking at, you know, runtimes that are like 40 cubed, as opposed to the actual R of this circuit, which is 8. So 8 cubed versus 40 cubed. So I should point out that this choice of R, this R value of 8 is not generic. So if you produce a bunch of circuits with these parameters without fixing R, you'll find that typically R will be higher. However, when R gets much higher than 8, so R values of, R values of 10 or higher at least, you will find that our compute algorithm starts to dominate and it becomes much faster in runtime than our estimate algorithm and any of these. And so, even though this is not a common choice of R, we have to kind of resort to this rare choices of R in order to even be in the regime where computers not dominating. And of course, computers producing output estimates that are not within a, you know, they're exact as opposed to additive errors of 5%. Okay. Are there any questions about this? Okay, I should also say, I guess, you know, this comparison is based on a single kind of choice of circuit parameters. And there's a very vast choice of circuit parameters. To our knowledge, we perform well across a wide range of circuit parameters against the kind of previous state of the art. But I think, you know, in order to really hone in on an interesting choice of parameters where one can compare these algorithms, you really need the interesting choice to be defined by a really useful application. So if anyone is interested in kind of applying these techniques, you know, please talk to me or let me know if you do these comparisons. Okay, so now I just want
to... If you go to larger N... No, sorry, mm-hmm. I didn't...
Yep. Super.
Yeah. If you go to larger N, do you expect the your data to approach the upper bound? Or I guess, are there...
Do we expect our runtime to...
Are there choices for the parameters where you expect the upper bound to be like relatively tight?
Sorry, when you say upper bound, you mean this stepped runtime upper bound or?
Yeah.
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 I don't know, Nick. So you're asking, do I expect the actual runtimes of this estimate algorithm to approach the upper bound of this set by this runtime algorithm as n gets large? Mm-hmm. I don't know, but I also don't see any reason why that would happen. Is there a reason why you might expect that to happen?
Other than just roughly like a upper bound, so I don't know. Upper bounds sometimes get tight if you take large dimensions or something. I don't have a good reason.
I don't know, but I don't think so. There's nothing I've seen in that suggests that might happen. Cool.
So I guess, yeah, so you think there might be room for optimization in the runtime upper bounds?
I mean, generically, I'd say the answer to that question is yes. Like, I don't think there's, you know, we don't have any results saying that this is the optimal upper bound you can have.
It's not so. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, so just a little bit of outlook, and I'm kind of almost finished here. So I think an interesting question that's not well understood is, can we predict properties of the compressed algorithm's output? So right now, our compressed algorithm is a bit of a black box. So for example, if we look at something like the R parameter, which is output of compress, certainly for any given circuit, we can run this through compress and get an R, but we don't really have an understanding of what microscopic properties of a quantum circuit give rise to a high R or a small R. And this would be really useful in trying to understand, you know, when our algorithms are effective, when our computer algorithm is effective, and when our estimate algorithm is effective. So I think, you know, this is a kind of important question in trying to better understand, you know, if you want to kind of talk about, you know, what quantum circuits are hard, or, you know, beyond just the practical application of these algorithms to really trying to draw some conclusions about, you know, what quantum circuits are interesting and what applications they might be useful for. It'd be useful to understand the answer to this question. I also think it'd be interesting to see if there are any practical applications for compute, and briefly discuss this earlier. And then kind of more kind of obvious avenues to pursue. One is that, you know, we developed a bunch of new techniques, and one might ask, can these be applied to improve the runtimes of sampling algorithms? So algorithms that that aim to sample from the output distribution of the quantum circuit. And that's kind of still an open question for us. And finally, one might ask, can we adopt the estimate algorithm to the mixed state formalism? And again, something we haven't really thought about yet. Okay, so that's the end of my talk. So thank you for your attention, and I'll open up to any questions.
I guess sort of a very vague question in line with your third bullet point. Like, have you tried running your algorithms on like random circuit, like choosing, you know, some random circuit to try and compute the upper probabilities?
Yeah. So
what you have in mind for the third bullet point, like sampling the output distribution of random circuits?
No, I guess in this, determining the Bournemouth probability for random circuits is something we've kind of looked at, and that's what, you know, that's where we were looking at the concentration of R and the R max and all that sort of stuff as well. But this is, I guess, to do with sampling from the output distribution, which means, I guess, all we're looking at doing here is, I mean, we're changing the definition of what it means to simulate. So rather than focusing on estimating Bournemouth probabilities, we're focusing on producing samples from the output distribution of the circuit such that the distribution of these samples is close in L1 norm to the actual quantum distribution. And so this, because this is a different task, it's not straightforward to go from like Bournemouth probability estimates to sampling. But some of these tools might actually be useful for that task. And so this point is to do with that. Although, one can kind of take this sampling from random circuits question, which is, you know, like interesting because of like, you know, Google's result on the supremacy stuff, and try to kind of make a similar version for Bournemouth probability estimation, where you kind of have to, sample a random circuit and then estimate Bournemouth probability. Yeah, sorry, I've just kind of gone off on a bit of a tangent, but I don't know, did that answer your question, Nick?
Yeah. I mean, my question was vague, but yeah, thanks.
Nice. Okay, I guess there's no more questions, so thanks for your time.